This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And already there's more than 94,000 people that are displaced, and well more than 650 people have been killed. So people are wondering what's next.
That's VOA's Heather Murdoch reporting from Tripoli. Details next. Also, at least five protesters are believed to have died in Sudan as pro-democracy protesters have again taken to the streets. And four South Africans are training to become the first all-female African team to climb the world's tallest peak, Mount Everest. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story: in Sudan, pro-democracy protesters have again taken to the streets today after protests in Khartoum and other cities turned deadly yesterday. After weeks of quiet, the protesters are again demanding that the transitional ruling council in charge negotiate with opposition leaders. At least five protesters are believed to have died, and the government says three members of the rapid support force were also killed. The government says the deaths were caused by unknown gunmen firing on the crowds. Reporter Naba Mohadin is in Khartoum and spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson earlier about the protests.
The protest was so big. There was no point before the protest, before June 30, because protesters were so scary. They were expecting a big repression by RSF or by security forces, because this is the first protest after June 3rd. People gathered in Matar Avenue, which is a very very big and important avenue next to airport. There were 10,000 of people in one avenue, and they also gathered in Bahri, more than 10,000 protesters, and in Umdurman also. They tried to reach the palace, the presidential palace, but security forces stopped them and fired tear gas against them. And people also protested in Madani, which is a very, very big state, very big city in Al Jazeera state, not far from Khartoum. And people also protested in Kassala and in Halfa. It was a really million-person march.
So my next question then is, what's going on today?
Today, people are still they are still protesting in some cities in Khartoum, because yesterday opposition told them to be in a sit-in in very big squares in the capital, but people were not organizing this. They were not expecting the sit-in, so they said it's better to protest every day because they don't know the security situation under the blackout of the internet and the unsecured situation. So people decided to protest every day to make the TMC hand over power for civilians.
Has there been any military or security force action today against protesters?
No, they just fired tear gas in Omdurman and in some places in Bahri to dispel the protest, but they didn't attack people and they didn't fire live ammunition. Not yesterday and not today. Just in Omdurman yesterday, they fired live ammunition and, number of victims died.
Right, right. Now, what is the military saying? What is the military government saying about the protest?
Military government said that they will reach an agreement with opposition leaders, which will satisfy Sudanese people very soon. And the deputy chief of TMC, General Hamdan Daglo, he said that the agreement will be announced soon and the negotiation will be continued soon.
How has the opposition reacted to that statement? Do they seem to think that there is going to be an agreement?
No, opposition has already stated that TMC is saying something and doing another thing, and that was so obvious from their rejection of integrating the mediation, the Ethiopian and African mediation, and opposition asked protesters to stay in the streets because they said that TMC is, they always say something and they do another thing. So there is no progression in the negotiation yet, and the opposition is still waiting for the promises that TMC kept saying for many days, even before the big protest.
That was Naba Mohadine in Khartoum. She was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Fighting has flared up again around Tripoli, where an army led by General Khalifa Haftar is trying to capture the city. Forces loyal to Libya's government of national accord, however, are pushing back against Haftar's forces and have regained lost ground. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Tripoli. She spoke with VOA's Steve Miller about the situation there.
Well, on Thursday and Friday, the forces supporting Tripoli and the Western internationally backed government took some key areas, including a strategic town called Garian. In response, the forces that are loyal to the eastern strongman, Khalifa Haftar, have vowed airstrikes and promised to attack the airport. And in fact, they did attack the airport, and it was closed briefly over the weekend. And they are saying that there might be an entirely new operation coming up against Tripoli in the coming few days.
The fighting in the area has been taking place for months now. How are residents reacting to these latest strikes?
Residents are increasingly tense and worried because at the beginning of this fight in 3 months ago, Haftar said he'd take Tripoli in 3 days or a couple of days, and it didn't happen. It's been 3 months, and it's been mostly a stalemate. But as it escalates, and it seems so very clear that neither side has any interest in backing down, the fact that they were so surprised that it lasted this long makes people think anything can happen. And already there's more than 94,000 people that are displaced, and well more than 650 people have been killed, so people are wondering what's next.
What about aid getting to those who are being displaced and caring to those who have been either injured in these attacks or directly affected by the collateral damage?
The aid available to displaced people has been coming through mostly local NGOs. There is quite a bit of local NGO work in Tripoli City. And because the city was attacked from the outside, the displaced folks have been coming further in. The camps we have been to where people, displaced people are staying say that they are pretty much full, and any large-scale further displacement would result in way overcrowding. One of the things, though, that is also impacting the city is that because all of the displaced people are coming further into the city, it's become increasingly crowded. It's impacted the economy, the infrastructure, almost everything in everyday daily life.
So are there any plans as to how to address that if this fighting, which has gone on for longer than anyone really anticipated, continues for the foreseeable future?
Not really. I mean, the Western forces insist that the country itself, if it's going to unite and work as function as one country, must do so through peace talks and elections. And the Eastern forces, Haftar's forces, say that the only way to unite the country is under his army. So they're kind of at a crossroads where they're actually fighting for, like, the very nature of the country. Is this country going to become a decentralized leadership and a democracy? Or is this country going to have another strongman leader, which, frankly, a lot of Libyans actually do want, certainly not all, but the result of this battle, if there is a clear result, will answer that question.
That was VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch speaking with Steve Miller from Tripoli. The Zimbabwe government has announced a measure that effectively makes maize the country's staple food, a controlled commodity. The measure comes as the country is faced with a dire humanitarian crisis due to drought and a crumbling economy. Adigando in Bulawayo has the story.
The Minister of Lands, Agriculture, Water, Climate and Rural Resettlement, retired Air Marshal Perrins Shiri, announced a statutory instrument which bans the buying and selling of maize among unauthorized persons in Zimbabwe. The statutory instrument says farmers can sell maize only to the state-controlled grain marketing board. The instrument bars the board from purchasing maize from individuals or companies who are not contractors. The Grain Marketing Board's Corporate Communications Officer, Joseph Katete, confirms the new regulation.
It was there before. So basically it means the trade-off is being monitored. There are only state institutions that are supposed to like the Grain Marketing Board. So they are using the Grain Marketing Act. What has been obtained is that it was liberalized in 2002. That means other traders like Ghana National Foods, they could buy even straight from farmers. But now they have to buy, farmers have to sell to the Grain Marketing Board. And millers and other people involved in the milling industry have to buy from the GMB.
Zimbabwe is in the midst of a drought due to the recurring El Nino phenomenon. The country has been saddled with low grain yields, and nearly 5.3 million Zimbabweans are estimated to be in urgent need of humanitarian assistance and protection, according to organizations such as World Vision and Relief Web. Katete confirms the thinking behind the government move.
This is a drought year. I think it's a drought year. So it's just to make sure that all the grains that we have in the country comes to the GMB.
The figure of the 5.3 million vulnerable includes the 3.8 million people in rural areas, including 2.9 million who are severely food insecure, and 900,000 people who are currently receiving humanitarian assistance. In addition, 1.5 million people in urban areas face severe food insecurity. Analysts question the cash-strapped government's capacity to move around the country to purchase and haul maize without burdening struggling farmers with transportation to depots. Economist Reginald Shoko is skeptical.
The measures are too stringent in terms of what is allowed to be sold without going to GMB, and how will they control it, especially given the fact that, you know, some of these most of the maize is with the communal farmers. How will government regulate and control? Remember, the biggest struggle and problem we have in this country is implementation.
Food insecurity in Zimbabwe is a result of a cocktail of factors, including climate change and poor planning. Further, Relief Web reports that pest infestations, including fall armyworm and tuta absoluta, have now spread to all provinces in the country, reducing output. The most at-risk people dwell in drought-prone rural areas, which depend almost entirely on rain-fed agriculture for their food and income. Given the ongoing economic crisis, observers say the situation is poised to deteriorate, further exacerbating the plight of the rural farmers who are cut off from the rest of the country. To mitigate against the effects of the drought, some economists say the agricultural sector needs to switch to farming small grains, which are more drought-tolerant, and other measures to cope with the drought. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
Past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. In Kenya, friends, officials, and the business community are mourning the death of Bob Collymore, the chief executive who helped to turn Safaricom into East Africa's most profitable company. Collymore died Monday, 2 years after he was diagnosed with cancer. Collymore, who was 61, took over as CEO of Safaricom in 2010. He led the company to dramatic growth, thanks in part to the popular mobile money transfer service, M-Pesa. The company's board will choose a successor soon. The Kenyan government owns 35% of Safaricom. President Uhuru Kenyatta said Collymore's contribution to our national well-being will be missed. Collymore was a Briton who was born in Guyana. He also had been an executive with South Africa's Vodacom and the European telecommunications giant Vodafone. A media ethics inquiry began in South Africa this week. The National Editors Forum launched the inquiry after allegations were made that some journalists received bribes from a South African company implicated in a corruption scandal. From Johannesburg, Yashira Ramprasad has the story.
Trust in journalism has eroded over the years all over the world, in large part due to the advent of fake news outlets and the widespread use of social media. The South African National Editors Forum says the declining public trust, combined with the weakening of editorial independence, pushed it to establish a public inquiry into the media. SANEF Executive Director Kate Skinner.
You know, the media plays an incredibly important role in terms of democracy. And we want, you know, members of the public to feel that we are taking the issues of credibility and ethics very seriously. We're hoping at the end that there will be an action plan, very clear recommendations as to what to do, and that some of those recommendations, for instance, would include strengthening ethical codes, ethical practices, and yeah, we wanted to basically address issues across the whole industry.
The inquiry follows allegations by Angelo Agretti, a former executive with the South African corporation Bosasa, that the company paid bribes to some journalists. Agretti made the allegations while he was testifying at a commission of inquiry into alleged state capture during former President Jacob Zuma's tenure. It's believed several companies paid bribes to Zuma and ministers for contracts and jobs for friends, among other things. Skinner says the inquiry will approach various people and groups for submissions and has set clear guidelines for how to take in information.
We're clear about, you know, the fact that we want this inquiry to be over in a year. We are also fairly clear around the issues of, you know, the different groups of people that we want to you know, make inputs. So it's media owners, it's journalists, it's editors, it's members of the public, but it's also, for instance, you know, groupings. So, for instance, Business Leadership South Africa would be asked to make an input, you know, churches, unions, so that we get a very good overview of what people are saying about the media and issues around credibility.
Skinner says the inquiry team hopes to get an idea of what went wrong with journalism in the country in recent years and whether some journalists really are on politicians' payrolls pushing their agendas. A report will be drafted once the inquiry is over, but it's not yet certain whether newsrooms will be made to adhere to stronger rules or ethical codes of conduct. It remains to be seen whether it will help newsrooms at all. I'm Yashira Rampasad for VOA News in Johannesburg.
After winning a landmark case that saw the Botswana High Court decriminalized same-sex relations, an organization representing gays and lesbians will now embark on a nationwide tour to educate members of the public about the meaning of the recent ruling. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Martin Ngwenya has the details.
The lesbians, gays and bisexuals of Botswana, Lekakipo, will particularly target religious leaders, teachers and nurses, among other key stakeholders who interact with homosexuals. Lekakipo Chief Executive Officer Anna Muloi Chalmers says following the High Court ruling, there is need to take the message to the public to explain what it means. She says religious leaders particularly have a misconception about the ruling.
I realize that Baruti, religious leaders are quite unhinged by the judgment. It could possibly be because of the messaging, the misunderstanding that it has something to do with marriage, and they are worried that they may be forced to marry us. So that sort of thing, it needs to be clarified.
She warns that religious leaders should desist from making hateful statements about homosexuals.
And also get the religious leaders to reflect about the statement they make, that when they make statements, they're talking about people, human beings with feelings, and the impact that such statements can have on people's life.
Chalmers says they've been discriminated at, even at health centers, and their countrywide tour is meant to ensure that healthcare workers understand the implication of the High Court ruling. She says it is critical that the ruling and its implication are explained across the country.
It's also critical that Botswana, not just from specific professions, Botswana in general, understand what this case means to them. Because it's not just about LGBTI. These are human rights. They transcend. The win for LGBTI is a win for members of the community.
Haboron resident Pauline Dukwelo applauds Lekakipo's move to take the ruling to the people.
Whether we like it or not, they're part of the society that we live in. They're part of us. So we need to come up with ways of learning how to live with them without stigmatizing them.
Botswana became the first African nation to decriminalize homosexuality through the courts. Kenya's High Court in May upheld its colonial-era laws against gay sex, dealing a blow to activists' hopes it would lead the expansion of gay rights in Africa. For VOA, this is Martin Ngwenya in Gaborone, Botswana.
The women mountaineers of Africa are reaching for new heights, following in the footsteps of the first black African woman to scale Mount Everest. Now, four other South Africans are training to become the first all-female African team to climb the world's tallest peak. Marisa de Klerk reports from Waterval Boven, South Africa.
Is there a specific way to do this, or just through and through?
But you know what it is to do.
And this?
A specific way. Yeah, you got like it right. This. That's it. Perfect.
Deshaun Dysel, Lisa Gehring, Tumi Mpahlele and Alda Waddle are training on the sandstone cliffs of South Africa's Drakensberg Mountains. They hope that next year they can become the first team of African women to conquer Mount Everest. The women are inspired by South African business executive Sarah Kumalu, who in May became the first black African woman to climb the world's highest mountain, which stands 8,848 meters tall. Africa has few mountains to practice on, but Kumalu says that is not a problem.
What excites me even more is that those coming behind us, or behind me, effectively won't have to struggle as much as I have had. You know, even though we're not born in a place where there are mountains, there's ice and snow, and more so when the ladies go in next year, I think it's going to open up even more doors.
Each team member does their own intensive mental and physical training along with group sessions to prepare for the difficult climb. Alda Waddle explains.
There's different elements that you need to train for. It is the technical, the equipment that you need to understand. It is the physical that you need to be able to do. And then also the cold. You need to be able to manage the cold. And then lastly is the altitude.
The inside looks like a... Looks like a... Boxing boot.
The women have different levels of experience in mountaineering. In 1996, Deshaun Dysel became the first black South African woman to set foot on Mount Everest. While she wasn't able to reach the summit, she scaled mountains on five continents.
When I first started high altitude climbing, there were so few women in the mountains. If I look around now, especially in the South African climbing community, that number definitely increased. And because of that, we have a greater pool of women to choose from. So why not have an all-female team?
As South African businesswomen, the team sees parallels with running a business in a male-dominated world and climbing the world's tallest mountain. They want their attempt to scale Mount Everest to inspire more African women to reach for the top. Marise de Klerk for VOA News, Waterval Boven, South Africa.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.